Welcome back to the third and final episode in the Acne Points of Discussion mini-series, Is iPledge Working? A Conversation on Isotretinoin. In our second episode, Dr. Friedan shared the challenges healthcare providers and patients face navigating this program. If you haven't had a chance to listen to episodes 1 and 2, be sure to do so before continuing on here. Before we begin, it's important to note the views and information expressed during this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the Pediatric Dermatology Research Alliance. The purpose of this podcast is to be thought-provoking and to stimulate new ideas, new collaborations, and novel research. Any reference to medical treatment or disease management is for this purpose only. It is not an endorsement by PDRA, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Any decisions related to medical care should be made in consultation with qualified healthcare providers. I'd like to introduce your host, Dr. Leah Lehler. Dr. Lehler is a practicing pediatric dermatologist at the Medical College of Wisconsin and vice chair of PDRA's Acne and HS Focus Study Group. I'd like to turn it over to you now, Dr. Lehler.
Thank you, and welcome to episode 3. In episodes 1 and 2, we discussed iPledge and isotretinoin use with two experts, Dr. Jill Lindstrom and Dr. Ilona Friedan. Here in episode 3, we'll have a discussion. Dr. Lindstrom and Dr. Friedan, let's discuss. So, Dr. Lindstrom, in episode 2, Dr. Friedan outlined some of the problems as she sees it with the iPledge system. Do you agree with the problems that she has outlined, and are there others?
iPledge is certainly not a perfect program. It's the issue of mitigating the risk of a serious teratogen, which is widely prescribed to people of reproductive age, is a challenging one. And I certainly agree that the program is burdensome and that there are enhancements that could be made. I think she also made an excellent point that there has been an evolution in the parameters of care with the evolution of the acne guidelines, the importance of antibiotic stewardship, the increased use of isotretinoin, changes in contraceptive options. Or these changes may provide a basis for re-examining the program to see if there are ways that the program can accommodate the changing landscape of clinical practice.
To kind of recap some of the issues that Dr. Friedan mentioned, she has said that there are those logistical challenges with the iPledge system that could result in us pushing the doses rather than individualizing treatment. There is an economic burden on patients and their families. There's an administrative burden on us in the clinics and our staff. Basically, as you mentioned, changing isotretinoin prescribing patterns with the changing landscape of acne treatment in general, with the labeling of oral contraceptives, with an indication for acne, and with the change in guidelines on antibiotic stewardship and the use of and treatment for acne in particular. And then, of course, she also talked about the long-acting contraceptives and their, you know, dramatic improvement on efficacy in pregnancy prevention, including people who can't get pregnant in iPledge as a system, that may not make a whole lot of sense anymore, or maybe didn't ever. And now the changing concept around gender identity and how we can serve all of our patients in a more equitable manner. With all of that in mind, I'd like to hear from you, Dr. Frieden. You kind of already mentioned in episode 2, I think, the answer to, or your answer to this question, but do you think iPledge could or should be eliminated?
I don't think iPledge will be eliminated. And so I think that's the more relevant answer, to be honest. I don't think my own personal opinion is as important as understanding that the FDA has an obligation for drugs that have risk potential. This is a drug where there are about 1 million prescriptions written a year for this medication, and a good percentage of those are in people who can become pregnant. And many, perhaps the majority, are in an age group where they can become pregnant, that this is not going to go away, that the FDA is not going to suddenly say, throw out their hands and say, well, okay, you know, do whatever you feel like doing. If you do the counseling in your office. They've already been down that road. And that, I just don't think that that's going to happen. So to me, it makes much more sense to try and create a program that includes elements that were not included in the original program, in part because it didn't really, the idea of sort of patient-centered, I don't really think that we thought about that as much as we do now when this program was instituted. And we have to think about, you know, acting on behalf of the interests of patients. And that I think is one piece of it. We have to think about disparities, and if they're being exaggerated, how do you mitigate that? And these are all things that I think are now part of our world and that people do think about. And then to me, the other piece is that if you want this to be a registry program, and Dr. Lindstrom talked about how essentially the iPledge iteration became a drug registry program. You cannot get this unless you register. So it is essentially a registry. If that's the case, that the people who are not really at risk for the most serious side effect of teratogenicity should have, in a way, it should be like registering your car. You renew it once a year or something, as opposed to registering, you know, something that's much more dangerous that somehow needs to be monitored more often. And maybe something along those lines would be a good way to look at this. But having said that, I think that there's broad consensus in dermatology that if it has to exist, that it needs to be very much reformed. I don't think, I think if we're able to get those changes through, that will be amazing for us as dermatologists. The problem that we're facing is that it's the problem of how do we get to that point? And we've really been trying this. The work group that I joined was in at the end of 2018. And here we are at the end of 2021, 2 years later. Now, obviously, things have happened in terms of we wanted to go and meet with people at the FDA, you know, we couldn't meet in person, things like that. But I would actually be very interested in hearing from Dr. Lindstrom, how do we go about trying to convene an advisory committee? You made a great point. It's been 10 years. That's a very long time for a drug that's used and that we have a lot of new information about how it's used and why it's used. And this seems like something that would be ripe for a new advisory committee meeting.
I agree. I think it certainly would be. In addition, the changes that are being implemented, I think, would have benefited from public discussion.
Well,
that would have also provided the opportunity to update on the public on information that has been gleaned over the 10 years since the last advisory committee and the 15 years that this program has been in operation or in existence. And there is indeed a treasure trove of information. It would be very interesting to see changes over time. Additionally, while personnel at FDA review this data, I think analysis by other minds could be very fruitful. How does one, to your question though, how does one convene an advisory committee? Advisory committees are, again, a statutory option that FDA has where they can seek input when they have questions, when they need to decide, when they need to regulate an issue that has a large public impact, something that may present a novel, either scientific or regulatory question. They can convene an advisory committee to get input and to air an issue. Those who are not an FDA can't convene an advisory committee for FDA. It's FDA that convenes the advisory committee. So it's not something that an outside person can do on behalf of the agency. The question is how to, a question might be why FDA has not had an advisory committee in so long, why they've moved from a position of ongoing discussion to really a long period of silence and introducing changes without any transparency, and why they have not thought it necessary to present the data from this program for discussion. So I think that these, you know, those are important questions. It's difficult. It can be difficult to get the agency's attention.
Yeah.
And this is in part because by design, there are firewalls, so to speak, to protect the individuals that work there from influence so that they can make unbiased determinations. However, that can lead to some insularity on their part. FDA has, I think, has some awareness of this and has an office of stakeholder engagement, which outside parties can engage with. But I don't want to, having been on the inside, I don't want to suggest that it is easy to have an audience with personnel there. Additionally, perhaps like many people, I think most personnel at FDA feel that they are, that the flow of information and responsibilities is rapid. And so that adds to the challenge.
I think that you make a really good point about the stakeholders too, because I think that unfortunately, you know, there's not like an Acne Vulgaris community support group kind of organization. I mean, so the Acne Rosacea Society is a professional organization. It's not a patient advocacy organization. There really isn't one to point to. What interestingly though, and this may be related and maybe something to think about in terms of trying to find a path forward. So the Foundation for Ichthyosis and Related Skin Types Research, they have a very big stake in this drug because it's the drug that all of these babies and people are on, many times for years and years, and they're ensnared in the system, even though the vast majority of them cannot become pregnant. And the consensus guidelines, which were partly through PDRA that came out for ichthyosis, which were published, and this is through the work of Andrea Zangline, who's been another part of our work group and is very involved in PDRA. She helped to write those guidelines. And one of the major problems that ichthyosis patients have in terms of barriers to care is eye pledge, actually. Mm-hmm. You might be able to, through trying to form political alliances, I think if they look at just the AAD or the Acne Rosacea Society coming, they can just say, well, these are doctors, they have a conflict of interest, they're, as opposed to the patients who do have a louder voice, but there's not a good patient advocacy group. So you could, of course, get lots of patients to come and testify. And maybe another group to consider that with in terms of strategizing are transgender individuals. And that's actually has has come out, you know, you have where you have a lot of potential advocacy voices there. So I think you could probably get together those kinds of individuals, plus people who represent some of the underrepresented groups that have suffered from health disparities, like Native Americans, because of their situation, and try and make the point that this should be looked at. Maybe that would be a good way forward.
Yeah, Dr. Lindstrom, you mentioned that it is difficult to get the attention of the folks at FDA. What does tend to get their attention?
Well, I think you've raised very good ideas with the rare disease groups. And I think that that's an important shortcoming of the REMS. Certainly there's burden on acne patients who may take this for a number of months, but the burden on someone who has a chronic disease and will take that drug for a much longer period, the burden is understandably much greater. That might be one community who would have a message that would resonate there. I think the cultural understanding across our nation, the growing cultural awareness of disparities, and it exists in FDA as well. I think that's quite broad in the nation, and perhaps raising awareness of disparities that are exacerbated because of the iPledge program may also be an important message to bring. Something that would also be helpful is coming with solutions. I think FDA actually would be interested in changes around more effective forms of contraception, the long-acting contraceptives. Their use reduces the risk that's trying to be managed. And that's FDA's goal, is to mitigate risk. So solutions that will help them better achieve their goal will catch their attention. And there's a potential, you know, intersection where that goal is achieved, and perhaps burden could also be lessened. So I think looking for intersections where risk can be mitigated and burden can be reduced may be fruitful and may resonate with personnel within the agency.
You mentioned bringing solutions, and Dr. Frieden, in a fairly recent paper, you mentioned that your work group, the DEA iPledge work group, put out basically a position statement outlining all the problems as the work group saw it with iPledge, and proposing some very insightful solutions. Would you be able to discuss some or all of those here? And Dr. Lindstrom, you can see, we can kind of see if some of these things would meet that intersection, as you mentioned.
There's a table in our JAMA Dermatology publication, which was from October 2019. And it really talks about that if you, for example, let's talk about long-acting contraceptives, that it proposed that currently, if you don't have a long-acting contraceptive, that you would have monthly documentation and attestation. But if you were documented to be on a LARC, as it's called, that it be every 3 months. And if you are not able to become pregnant, that it would be every 6 months. So we didn't say throw the whole system out. We said this would be a way to sort of pull back to a system that still meets the goals of the original intent of this. So that's basically what was said in terms of required number of forms of contraception, you know, that for patients who are able to become pregnant, but they're not on long acting, that you would stick with two, that in LARC, you would basically have one, which is a change to the requirement, that currently abstinence is also one, but these would be people who wouldn't be abstinent necessarily, most probably. And then basically the baseline pregnancy screening would be for those who are not on a long acting, but have but able to become pregnant, 30 days prior to initiation, which really isn't a change. But for LARC, it would be really at initiation, and they would not have the sort of washout period, which to us made sense. And then if they're not able to become pregnant, obviously they don't do that. And those weren't really the, in terms of for pregnancy screening, it would be similar to the attestation. So with the non-LARC patients, it would be monthly. With the LARC patients, it would be every 3 months or as per patient preference. So those are like the major changes that were proposed. I think that those are good proposals. I think that I would hope that if we can get the hearing from the people who really need to buy into this, which would be the sponsors and the FDA, if we can get to the point where we can get a hearing and we can state the reasons for this and the downsides. I always like to say to my patients, who say to me, oh, I don't want to try a medication because there are side effects. And I like to say to them, yeah, but there are side effects from not taking the medication too, So this is not a situation where there's no side effects from leaving the situation the way it is. There are side effects and we're all experiencing them. So that's why we need to move forward. And like I said, I'm an optimist. I mean, this has been so far a 3-year journey, but I'm hoping to be around for a few more years to see it to a happier ending. But we will see. I think Dr. Lindstrom has given us some good ideas in terms of at least approaching the Office of the Stakeholders. We have some other things that I think the AADA is going to try to do. But I feel a little bit discouraged this week because what we found out this week is that the drug will now be classified into able to become pregnant and not able to become pregnant. But the entire registration system was revamped, and without, to our knowledge, it doesn't have to be dermatologist, any prescriber, which by the way is almost exclusively dermatologist, any prescriber input about how that was going to work out in practical purposes in our offices. And we're talking about for busier practices, 5 to 10 patients a week sometimes who are being registered into the system, with asking them just to be doing this in their doctor's office and with the doctor present. These are things that are really a step backwards. So this is not to denigrate the advance in terms of the reclassification into pregnant and not pregnant. I think that we have to claim that as a victory. I think it is a victory, but we have a long road to go before this is over.
Dr. Lindstrom, what do you think about those solutions that Dr. Frieden just outlined? Do those seem like things that could fit in that intersection of mitigating risk, but also reducing burden? It sounds pretty good to me.
Some do. I think identifying LARC as a form of contraception that doesn't require a second form makes good scientific, good medical sense. And I think that there would be openness to a change like that. And I don't think it would be difficult, analogous to abstinence being the quote unquote two forms. The changes proposed where someone on a long acting contraceptive or a patient who cannot become pregnant needing to engage less frequently with iPledge quarterly or at some less frequent interval presents more challenge. There's appeal to that. It would reduce burden, but it introduces complexity and risk. So there's complexity that would be introduced to the iPledge program, right now, all categories of patients interact every month. And, oh, well, why? Who cares? Well, if you look at the broader system of iPledge, pharmacists don't need to think about Leslie Smith, whether Leslie Smith can get pregnant or can't get pregnant. There's the process that the pharmacist goes through is the same for every patient. And there's benefit to that, and that it makes for a tighter system, a system less likely to have errors. Additionally, if you look over the history of the discussions leading up to the implementation of iPledge, the advisory committee transcripts and the advisory committee votes and conclusions very strongly recommended registration of all patients. And at the time, they used the language males and females. We can now sort of update their sense of those that can become pregnant and those that can't become pregnant. And I don't want to summarize what they were thinking, but my understanding of what they were thinking, again, is to provide a system that is as robust as possible. So I have concern that it might be more difficult to achieve the recommendations around differential frequency of engagement for patient groups. Now, just because I'm not optimistic that that might not occur doesn't mean that it shouldn't be pursued. It just means that I recognize that there are challenges to that, that it wouldn't have the same appeal, so to speak, because it presents challenges and it may even increase risk from the agency or the sponsor's perspective. At some point earlier, we discussed, I think it might have been in the introduction, or perhaps Dr. Frieden, is in your prior section, the impact of telemedicine. And one thing that comes to mind for me, in addition to the changes in the practice landscape, are the advances in technology over the years. 10 years is a long time, and technology has changed over that time. And the recent pandemic, the ongoing pandemic, has forced us and has forced us all to change, and forced the FDA and the iPledge program to accept changes such as home pregnancy tests and telemedicine visits. And the world did not end. It would be very interesting to see the data, and maybe a point worth almost, I don't want to say demanding, but strongly requesting that we need to see what was the impact of those changes. The public should be made aware. That should be presented for public discussion. That, in my mind, is another strong reason to consider the Drug Safety and Risk Management Advisory Committee convening a meeting to discuss whether some of the changes, the impact that they had, and whether they could be continued, and some efficiencies maybe, or some reduction of burden may be able to be achieved based on what we've learned.
What a fascinating point. I have been wondering, how did we get such rapid approval to do telemedicine and to get home pregnancy tests for our patients on isotretinoin at the beginning of the pandemic, when our offices were closed and we didn't really know what was going to happen and how soon we would be open again, and not wanting to expose patients unnecessarily when masks were at a shortage and we didn't even know masks were important or needed, or how the virus was spread. I mean, all those things. Yeah. We wanted people to continue on their medication and comply with the guidelines and stay safe, both from a teratogenicity perspective, but also from a virus perspective. So I did wonder, how did that happen so quickly? And I am very curious to see the data about that. And that just brings us back to the research that not only the clarity of transparency with all of these data, but now what can we do with that data to help us understand how to keep our patients safe, how to get them an effective drug, and how to advocate and advocate for them and keep the drug in the right hands.
I left the agency in December of 2019. And so I'm present. It was an interesting time to return to clinical medicine.
Yeah.
At the cusp of the, or you know, at the cusp of the pandemic. At any rate, so I was not on the inside to know how that happened, but I can surmise that there was engagement between the agency and the sponsor group. And I think that both the agency and the sponsors deserve our commendation for their nimbleness and the way that they did address that and the way that they served patients in making those changes and taking risk. And I would give a shout out to my colleagues within the agency for being nimble and rising to the challenge.
It's interesting, you know, I think you're quite right. The sad fact that we have no idea really what happened, it, again, points to the sort of lack of transparency to the stakeholders, but I think they made the right call. That said, the iPledge requirements are, as I said, kind of agnostic. It's not explicitly permitted to do telemedicine in the iPledge program, but everyone is doing it now, sort of. But it wasn't like written in, like, okay, we didn't get an advisory saying, okay, well, now that's okay, which we would really like to have. And I think there are other, you know, along the lines of what you said, you know, even if, and I would hope that they would, you know, the whole issue of the pharmacy, I hadn't thought really, to be honest, about that piece of it, of what comes to a pharmacist. But it would not be impossible to have a quick, you know, you got an in-basket message that said, I attest that this is a non-reproductive, and you sign that month's prescription without having to see the patient, kind of thing, or interaction even with the patient, would be better than the system we have now. So if it comes to that, there probably are many ways we could figure out how that could be done. So I think there's a lot to explore in terms of brainstorming and thinking about, but you've given us a lot of, I think, ideas for that. And maybe offline we can get your input about how to move forward, or maybe
be a future collaboration.
Yes, exactly. Maybe you would help us to figure out
classic PDRA collaboration already forming. I did want to mention that I'm no computer scientist or coder or whatever, but it seems to me that it would be fairly easy to code something where if you click a button that says on long-acting reproductive, their confirmation is good for 3 months, and that, or whatever we're proposing. Well, I know that's what the Dr. Frieden was proposing, was a 3-month confirmation. Of course, we can debate the medical utility in that and all of that, like what's the data behind that. But it seems to me like it would be an easy coding thing to just say that confirmation is good for however much time. It's still the same, the pharmacist, same each month. They check it just like they are now, and the confirmation is still good. So I feel like that may be less of a problem on the pharmacist end, though I maintain my right to be wrong about that, my naivety about how pharmacies work.
It may be. As long as they were still dispensing, you know, 30 days supply, then it would be transparent, or it would be, you know, invisible, so to speak, to the to the pharmacist. So, an incremental change, I think, is possible.
Well, I think this has been a truly fascinating discussion. I have learned so much from both of you, and I so appreciate both of your willingness to be open and vulnerable in this discussion and, you know, open to each other's ideas in particular. I mean, we're all obviously on the same team, just coming from slightly different perspectives and experiences. I wanted to ask one last question of each of you. And, you know, we keep coming back to this idea of lack of transparency, that the data is out there, but we can't see it. We don't have access to it. What sort of things could we do with that data if we had it? What research projects are burning on your minds? What do you want to know from that data? What can we learn from it? Dr. Lindstrom, maybe you could start.
A descriptive, using it to understand the universe experience that has been the previous 15 years, exploring the data. It's hard for me to even say what questions I'd like to have answered. Certainly, changes more recently since
home pregnancy
tests with COVID, right? Before and after, seeing the impact there would be an obvious and easy question. I think there's just so many questions. Where is the risk? Is it in what age group? In what demographic? What's impacting that? I think there's many questions that could be asked.
I know I'd like to see that data. I got a lot of research questions. Dr. Frieden, what are your thoughts?
I agree with Dr. Lindstrom very much that there's so much out there. We don't even know, one question will lead to another, but I don't think we have a really good sense of the landscape at this point of even in a granular way, who's getting the drug and for how long they're getting it. So practice patterns in itself, I think, would be very, very important. How many patients end up needing repeat courses is something that we don't really, because it's kind of hidden away from us in a sense in this system, but, and yet very available because we have registries are rich with data. So to be able to study a registry, it's the very reason you form registries, right? And usually getting a registry going costs millions of dollars. Well, this has already been paid for by all of us, basically, by the farm manufacturers and their profit, take their profit and take a little bit for the registry, et cetera. So I think there's an incredible amount of information there. I think to the extent that we might be able to look at health disparities by zip code and things like that would be very, very important in terms of not just who gets it by zip code, which I think that you probably might be able to get data from pharmacy databases on that, but who drops out sooner because they literally can't continue the program. So you have shorter courses for people in certain areas versus other areas. Or are there demographic groups that are more at risk for not being able to complete a course because they just can't, it's too much. Those would be very, I think, very, very interesting health services research. So I hope that we're able to come back in a year or two and with and talk about what the next steps are.
Indeed.
I hope so too. Well, this has been incredibly interesting. Thank you both so much for your time. I look forward to talking with you both more about this in the future.
Thank you.
Likewise. A great privilege. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to our first Points of Discussion miniseries about the iPledge program. I hope this third and final episode on this topic has you thinking about the kind of research data transparency might lead to and sparks new ideas and new projects moving forward. Thank you to Dr. Leah Lehler for moderating all three episodes and leading an engaging and thought-provoking discussion. Thank you to Dr. Lindstrom and Dr. Frieden for providing expert knowledge and insight into the iPledge program and its benefits and challenges. I would also like to thank our Points of Discussion program sponsors, AbbVie Inc., Eli Lilly and Company, and Sanofi Genzyme and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals for their support of this independent medical education program. If you have thoughts on the iPledge program, or if this series has sparked new research ideas, we'd love to know. Send us an email at info@pedraresearch.org. To listen to more Pedra programming, be sure to subscribe to Pedra Pearls podcast in iTunes, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Download the Pedra app, available for Apple and Android users, and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn for more pediatric dermatology research content. December's Points of Discussion miniseries will tackle the use of sunblock in infants with Pedra's Neonatal Focus Study Group. You won't want to miss it. Pedra is solely responsible for all program content and the selection of all presenters, authors, moderators, and faculty.